Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're bringing you, as usual, news of lots of stuff stirring up in the pot, shall we say, of the food and wine industry. And there's always something happening, and right now there is a big thing going on, and we're going to talk to Omar Cantu, chef, whose restaurant Moto in Chicago has become the de facto headquarters of something called the Trotter Project, which is, as you can guess, in memory and honor of Charlie Trotter, who died so precipitously and sadly, yes, indeed. And it's really, it's a beautiful kind of tribute which will unfold over a period of time. We don't know all the details. You can follow the conversation we had with Omar Cantu, and also you can follow the developments on social media, particularly Twitter. And I don't know what to say. There's something happening every minute. I've already had three more emails about events centering on this Trotter.
You may be sure. It sounds like a big thing. It's
worldwide.
Might make converting El Bulli into a museum.
Playing
second fiddle to something. And Charlie didn't like to play second fiddle to anybody. So
no,
I'm sure that you'll want to watch this space. And there are some interesting clues if you listen closely to what Omar had to say. You'll already get an idea of some of the dimensions and some of the aspects of what's going to be going on. So,
Chef Omar Cantu, I'm really excited about this project you're working on, titled the Charlie Trotter Project. And
yeah, I'm just one of hundreds working on this thing.
You know, are all the people involved alumna of Charlie's restaurant?
Oh no, it's chefs from all over the world. I mean, you name the chef, they're involved in some capacity or are aware of it. From Michael Ruhlman to Mario Batali, Danielle Ballud, Norman Van Aken, everybody.
Outline for our listeners just what you're trying to do.
Well, Chef Trotter was the most innovative chef in years. First tasting menu, the first wine progression, the first raw food experience, the first vegetable experience, believe it or not.
When we talked to him last, I wanted to come back on the show and talk about raw food, and we never got to do that. But he was really up on that, wasn't he?
Yeah, I actually worked on the raw food. Okay, so I was working on the vegetable station, and he came up to me and said, "Hey, I want you to make a raw food dish for me every day, see where it goes." And so I did this for months, and eventually, you know, Guillermo Tejas, the, you know, one of the big bosses there, he was, you know, shooting the dishes for the book, and we stumbled upon really fascinating things like Ramajan, raw vegan Parmesan cheese things, raw cookies, raw bread, and it just really expanded my mind as to how raw food could be a catalyst for creating good things. So I make him this dish. It's actually in the book. It's morel mushrooms with lotus root chips and beet foam.
Wow.
And this was the first dish that looked like an actual Charlie Trotter dish, but it was raw. And so he takes a look at the dish. It's 9 a.m., and it's just him and I in the kitchen. Takes a look at it, he's like, "Omar, I want to talk to you." And so he said, you know, food should be delicious first, and then as a secondary byproduct of that delicious food, it should be healthy second. And, you know, that should just always be present. And that's the whole point of raw food. And so I carried that with me. You know, my fascination with healthy junk food is really delicious, healthy food that maybe mimics all the other foods.
So that's how we got to that. Now, I guess Tetsuya is involved too, huh?
Tetsuya Okuda, he was in town when Chef Trotter passed away, and, you know, all of these ideas started percolating. You know, what can we do to carry on Chef Trotter's vision? Because he had a very simple philosophy. There's always a way to take it to the next level, and that's what we're going to do as good students.
That's wonderful. Now, it involves buying the house? I mean, the restaurant building?
Yeah, the buildings are a piece of the real estate component. family has generously donated $100,000 to the foundation to get it jump-started, but there's going to be many announcements this year, and it's going to be just a really exciting mash of the latest in good technology and food, and we're just going to see what's possible.
Well, I mean, I see a lot of chattering on Twitter about it. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it's still pretty secret. Is there anything you can tell us more specific that's not so secret?
Yeah, so imagine if you could use science and math to determine the experience in a restaurant. There's a lot of systems out there that are not, what I would say, transparent. You don't know who this person is or that person. And with this system, you still won't know what they are, but their reviews will be authenticated. They will actually have been at the restaurant, and you'll be able to see the reviews in real time on the Trotter Project website. I can't go into any more detail than that, but that's where it starts. And this idea is going to put billions globally back into small, independent food and beverage operations.
Now, what Omaru, what happens with the building? Does it become a school? Does it become a laboratory? Does it stay a restaurant? What is it going to be?
Well, that's part of the release of information throughout the year, but I can tell you that the real estate will be a part of it, and the real estate will be explosive.
And now you really have me curious. But you're not going to reveal.
Not yet, but you'll see it. We're starting on Twitter and Facebook. You want to follow at Trotter Project. That's where the information will be trickling out. But then you get to a point where we've got the big thing, the big reveal, and that's when we're going to bring in our press partners and, you know, give you access to it, and then you can go and do your thing. You really want to talk to Derek Hall about that.
Okay. Well, he's the one I've been corresponding with about talking to you. Yeah. And he's at Moto, right?
He does Moto, the entire Cantu restaurant group, Cantu Designs, and the Trotter Project.
I see. Now, there has to be an educational component involved with this, I'm sure, since that was so primary to Charlie's interests.
Yeah, we are going to change the game on education. What we're going to do is we're going to drop the cost that it takes to go through a culinary program, but the teachers are going to make more money. The restaurateur is going to get a higher quality employee, and it will be free for anybody to do.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's really amazing.
I sort of envision what you're doing is creating a more modern, in the Midwest, a more modern Beard Foundation. Is there anything like that?
Nope. The Beard Foundation, you know, they do a completely different program. We support them. We think that the Beard House has really done an exceptional job of taking food and making people aware that there are certain things that they can do in food to make food better. And so we're just taking a slightly different approach. We would love to partner up with them. In fact, we're doing a beard dinner on September 22nd. We'll be donating $7,500 to the Beard House, and then we'll donate $13,500 to the Trotter Project at the same dinner. Wow. It's actually for female chefs. Claire Crenshaw is heading it up. We got all these amazing female chefs from around the world, and we're really just kind of saying, hey, to support women in the kitchen. Charlie was a huge proponent of that, and I'm letting Claire sort of direct this boat.
Wow, how do I get on that mailing list?
Just talk to Derek. If you get on our mailing list at motorestaurant.com or, you know,
okay.
You can see it there.
Yeah, and I mean, how big a push is it going to be having the Beards in Chicago next year?
Well, you never know what we're going to announce, so there could be something that would be a great little pairing, almost like the perfect food and wine pairing, if you could imagine that, with a charity foundation.
Wow. Now, initial reports indicated that Charlie's widow had her own ideas. Is she coming around to join in the effort?
Oh, you know what? We just saw Rochelle at the American Culinary Federation. She had wonderful things to say about us, and, you know, we had wonderful things to say about her. We love what she's doing. She announced a $25,000 scholarship from the Culinary Education Foundation, which Charlie started, you know, over a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just slightly different approaches, but really the same goal of helping the community. Charlie took this idea that a chef is not really a chef until he is a constant giver. And, you know, nobody gave more than Charlie. I mean, every week we'd be doing these events, you
yes.
know, to raise money for either Share Our Strength or No Kid Hungry. These are great things to continue to support. And that's really, we're basically in the same mentality where we want to do that. And so it's really just so many layers, so many people, hundreds of people come up with an idea and we say, yes, is that a good idea or a bad idea? Well, it's a good idea. Is it a good idea to put billions back into local independent restaurants? Good idea. Let's go ahead and give that a shot. Is it a good idea to re-release the cookbooks in a completely innovative and exciting way? And we're working on that. And all of these amazing programs that happened because Charlie gave us the blueprint for this. This is not something that we just thought of out of the blue. This is like working at Charlie Trotter's. This is just what happens. But over the past 25 years, he amassed this army of hundreds of people that think the same way about giving back to the community. And now that we're working together, this becomes very explosive. So it'll be a good business model for people to adhere to, but it's also going to be an innovative charity in the respect that it takes good technology and puts it in the hands of people that could use it.
Grant Achatz is involved too?
Welcome everybody to be involved. Right now, the alumni are working quietly behind the scenes. And so we're putting out there just some of the endorsements from non-alumni chefs. We didn't want to make anybody upset. Say we were to just put Matt out there, it would be unfair to all the other alumni. We're in a very democratic system. So at this point, everybody is welcome to be a part of it. I can't give you details about specific programs because then I'd know.
I would know.
Then the cat will truly be out of the bag then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got to do it right, you know.
I understand.
Well, you know, I would think that so many people would make a fairly unwieldy organization.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly move. Just look at Twitter. Twitter is really key because never before in the history of food have you been able to take the collective intelligence of thousands or millions of chefs and whittle it down into a single post and round up the troops to handle some of the biggest challenges in food. Anytime you read about, like, you know, food challenges like food miles or food deserts, that's just an opportunity, kind of like the horse and buggy was an opportunity to create a car. You know, somebody did it. And really now we have a collective intelligence. I have this saying, I like to think we're all eyes in the same head. And we really are when it comes to social media. So we're really leveraging that and taking everybody's good ideas and saying, we're going to do that, and at a future date you're going to see what we came up with.
Now, where are you personally in your career at this point? You look, by the way, fabulous.
Wow, thanks.
She says that to all the guys.
No, you know what I mean.
In my career, I would say that I'm at a stage where I'm focusing on research and development. We're opening up a couple small concepts, a coffee shop and a brewery. And then after that, I'm going to go right into 100% research and development and heading up maybe a research facility that's sort of like Xerox PARC. You know, let me ask you a question. What's the most technologically advanced, technology company or innovative technology company around the planet?
Right now, probably Apple, I would think.
Okay, now what's the most technologically or innovative food company around the planet?
That would be a short list.
Pretty short list, right?
So, it would be a very short list.
We need a company that comes in and says, hey, we've got ideas, we've got solutions, and start a whole new race, like a space race, if you will, in food that knocks everything out of the park, gives you what you need. As a consumer, as a diner, zero food miles, healthy junk food, just crushes the... peels the skin off the ball every year with new updates with new products, and it's free for people to use. That is key.
Let me run a couple of things by you, Chef, that just crossed my mind. First off, when we heard that Charlie had passed, we realized that we had sound we had recorded in the past with him, including a 32-minute interview that was supposed to be the first installment of several. This is sound we'd be delighted to forward to you for your use anywhere in relation to the project, if you'd like.
That would be amazing. I have a number of voicemails from Charlie that he left me. Some of these things are like 10 minutes long.
Well, his interview with us was 35 minutes, and he almost didn't breathe along the way. He had so much to say.
Working with Charlie, you could see the thoughts racing beyond how he would describe them. And that's what was so exciting about working there.
Okay.
The ideas were much further ahead than what we were even capable of doing.
Well, I'll definitely do that. There was another connection I wanted to mention to you. I have no idea if this will be of the slightest interest, but Chef Pierre Gagnier is involved with a gentleman who heads up an institute in Paris that deals with food. And
is that Hervé Thys?
Hervé Thys, yes. Yeah, so you know him already?
Yeah, I actually did a project with Hervé in 2006 for the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts.
Okay, well, I just wanted to mention it.
Yeah, brilliant. If you could put him in touch with Derek, then we could be a part of it and maybe lend something to it with the Trotter Project, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, do we have Derek's email address?
Yes, I have Derek's email address.
Let me send him the sound file that I promised you, and I'll include Hervé's contact information.
Okay, cool.
Now, I wanted to ask you, since you were the first one who started in exploring things with printers, where are you on the subject of 3D printers for food?
I disagree with it. So here's the thought. Why would you grow a tomato to dissect it to put it back together in a printer when you could just eat the tomato? It doesn't make sense. But, you know, like the first light bulb didn't really work out experimentally. The technology got better, so now we have reliable LEDs. At the end of the day, you have to try something once, see if it goes anywhere. So for space travel, maybe there's 3D replication technology that's applicable to something useful. Maybe not. But it was an interesting learning experience. Really what I gained out of that, we invented printed sushi, so it looks like sushi is made out of sushi. It's made out of rice, soy, and seaweed. But what if we could make replicated donuts, sugar-free donuts that taste as good as real donuts, made from ingredients that you can grow in your backyard? Those types of things, replicated food products are really a big opportunity, meaning we unjunk the junk food. You know, that is how we think about that.
I just don't seem to understand it. I try, but I could see it with sugar, for example. But I can't get my head around savories with it.
Well, savory foods have a lot of salt, and they have cholesterol and, you know, things like that. And really, anytime you read the paper about a challenge, I like to call them challenges, high blood pressure, whatever it is, that's just an opportunity that has not been tapped into. And so we can address that nowadays with the exchange of information on Google and, you know, Twitter and all this stuff. And so we can exponentially increase the efficiency to solving those challenges.
So you're coming at it from a different direction from how this, we interviewed somebody with a software, a 3D printer called Foodini.
I know those guys.
Okay, well, I didn't understand what they were doing because I read where it took so long to print this stuff, and she's saying it takes, like, no human intervention and printing in seconds or minutes, and also she's working on how to cook the food at the same time.
Yeah, so that 3D printer, that may have really good applications for people with disabilities who can't cook.
Interesting.
And so can't move your hands, or you can't sauce a plate or whatever it is, that may have good applications for the wider population. I don't think it's going to, you know, it's going to have those applications. But still, that is a major opportunity for someone to be able to take somebody with a disability and make them a dish that's organic and delicious and created, you know, there in your kitchen, whereas otherwise they would have to eat something that not be as delicious.
Well, you were amazing, Moreau. I mean, absolutely amazing. You're thinking of things that never even crossed my mind. So, yeah.
Well, you know, we worked on that food replicator project with Hervé Thys for the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts. That was in 2006, before printing technology had the ability to really handle food. And that was for the manned mission to Mars. Some astronauts are going to need to get to Mars, but they want apple pie. They don't want freeze-dried stuff. So mentally, we want the food that we grew up with. We want grandma's cooking. We want all that stuff, but we got to unjunk that food and make it look and taste exactly like that, made from wholesome scratch ingredients. That's what we want.
Yeah, well, of course, Hervé, I think he's really aiming for feeding the world, basically.
And I believe that's going to happen with indoor farming. I believe that we'll be able to flip the switch and your products just grow in a closed-loop food-mile gastronomy farm. They'll be cheaper than the stuff that you get from the grocery store. The grocery store and make more money if we do this. The farmer makes more money. That's the definition of sustainability. When you create a product or you do something, everybody along the food chain can still have a living, maybe make more money. Growth stimulates, you know, income. And so as we grow technologically in food exponentially, like our cell phones have exponentially increased in price performance, everybody is going to be along for the ride, including and especially developing nations, food deserts, and ghettos.
Well, Omara, you must promise to let us know when you have new announcements to make about the Trotter Project.
We hope you'll
take advantage of us being able to put that out on the air faster and in your own words than anybody else, probably. So be sure to keep us in the loop.
Okay, yeah, just stay in touch with Derek Hall. He's going to take care of you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. You take it easy, and we'll chat in the future.
Okay. I'll come visit you in Chicago, too. I'm due for that. Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much. I look forward to serving you. All right,
thank you, dear. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
So now you know the latest about the Trotter Project, whether it's a clue or whether it's the real thing, we'll know only as the future emerges, but you may be sure that we'll have that news at On the Menu Radio, and we'll bring it to you as soon as we have anything that we think is more useful information. In the meantime, as Anne suggested, there's a lot of social media going on about it, so you can tune into Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. And in the meantime, it's time for us to take a break because we have more business to do in today's show.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, I'm going to look back in the day to tell you that the first time we encountered Dean Fearing, we were at the mansion on Turtle Creek, where he
was cooking up a storm, we might add.
Yes, indeed. And he now, of course, has moved on. He has his own restaurant still in Dallas, and he has undertaken the Texas Food Bible. The state of Texas is very big. The food scene there is very large, and so is this book. Dean Fearing, reading the Texas Food Bible that you just published, takes me back and back and back, and I'm very nostalgic about Texas. We last were at, when you were at the mansion in Turtle Creek, that was a long time ago, we were there, and it just, I haven't been in Texas. I know Austin. I know Dallas. I have never been in Houston. Who comes to Texas nowadays?
Everybody comes to Texas. It's international.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, we have a lot. Being at DFW is an unbelievable source for us with Qantas, so we get everybody from New Zealand and Australia, and then all the direct lines to Europe, and now into Tokyo and into the Far East. So, you know, we really have become quite international in Dallas for just this worldly amount of people traveling through.
Yeah, well, you have to connect through Dallas for a lot of flights.
Sure do.
We did that for years. Tell me this. How did an Eastern Kentucky boy like you end up in Dallas?
You know what? It was my dad being in the business. My dad was a general manager for Holiday Inn. We traveled the whole Midwest with him opening up Holiday Inns for Kemmons Wilson in the 60s when Holiday Inn first came out of Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, is that where it came out? I didn't know.
And so I was always in the business. And what was great growing up in the business is that I wanted to further my cooking ability. So I went to CIA, Culinary Institute of America, in Hyde Park, New York. And then my first job out of school was at the Masonette in Cincinnati.
Oh, my God. I forgot about that place.
Oh, boy, that was a fine restaurant. I mean, that.
Oh, I couldn't have lucked out any better. And working with George Hayden there for 2 years, he said, you need to work in a 5-star mobile guide hotel. And he got me into the Pyramid Room at the Fairmont in Dallas, Texas. And that's what brought me into Texas, mainly Dallas, in 1978.
But, you know, it must have been a hard transition because you were born in the South. Your training at the CIA had to have been classical, French primarily. And here you're in this wholly different world with all these strains of influences from all over.
And I got to tell you, I pulled in with my new 1978 brown fastback Celica Toyota with everything I owned in that car. And when I came upon Dallas, and I saw that it was a brand new city, I fell in love.
Oh,
and I fell in love so hard, I have never left. You know, and I honed all of my culinary skills right here in Dallas.
Well, you had so many influences that you talk in your book about all the special Mexican dishes that ingredients that people brought you, and that was a whole new world, huh?
Well, it was, and it was a world that I've never been exposed to. So, learning about Mexican cuisine, learning about how to do true Texas barbecue, learning all of those unbelievable new food tastes that I've never been exposed to, I was eating it up. But I came as a young French cook. The Pyramid Room at the Fairmont at the time, which was 5-star mobile guide, was all French. I mean, the whole town was French.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I opened my own restaurant in 81 that we were the first American white tablecloth restaurant in Dallas. And all I wanted to do was what Wolfgang Puck was doing with Spago's and Larry Forgione was doing in New York City with American Place. I just wanted to open my own American style restaurant. And if you hear all of that, that's amazing at that time.
Yeah, well, you forged mainly what we call Southwestern American cooking, right? But there's never been a time when you weren't tops in ratings and in the news. You've been the darling of food media for as long as I can remember.
Well, thank you.
Well, you are.
what's it like to be a darling? it sounds like you're watching that television program.
Well, let's get down to some nitty-gritties about you have the first section in your book is wonderful. It's all about your pantry. Fearing Texas pantry. And everything you need to know about the ingredients that appear in Texas cooking is found in this section.
Well, and that was Judy Choate's idea. You know, in fact, I think we had a fight over that. I was like, really? You know,
really?
Judy, do we want to start off with that? But she was so right. And Judy was my cookbook editor, and she was like, no, on this book, we need to let people know what they need. We got to enhance them on what is the sole part of this book, and that is exactly it.
She's wonderful, wonderful editor, writer, and cook. She cooks.
Oh, she sure is.
No, in a way, to sort of summarize it, it's really like you're cooking for the Republic of Texas.
Well, we are our own country, you know.
Well, that's what I meant. You tried to be for a while, but remember the Alamo. That first effort wasn't very successful.
Right. Well, you know, a bunch of Kentuckians and Tennesseans helped forge that. So.
and then we have King Richard.
That's right.
King Richard Perry.
That's right.
I bet the crown fits him real well. But it's really quite amazing how southwestern Dallas and Texas cooking in general has become from where it started out. As you said, it was a copy of things French, and now it has its own.
Of course, the rest of the world was like that.
But yeah, I understand. But now it has its own incredible identity.
Oh sure.
And
one of the great regional cooking.
But when you went there, you've left out the great learning experience you had in Cincinnati, where you learned about chili 3, 4, and 5 ways.
Oh, let me tell you, I was addicted to, what's it called? It's
3-way, 4-way, and 5-way.
Yeah, 3-way, but the name of the place is
Skyline Chili.
Skyline. Boy, that was our haunt after work when we worked. Yeah. You know, we would all go there after the bars closed.
and now you make it with no beans. Now here's a question.
Absolutely, Peter.
The answer's probably in the book, but I don't remember because I remember the fascination of being in Houston and also being way down in San Diego in California. And in both of those places, when you ordered chili, it came with cubed meat.
Yes.
Now, is that the
very Texas style?
That's very Texas too. So, see, in the rest of the world, it's all made with ground meat.
Not in my house growing up, it was always cubed.
Except by me. I mean, I make it the Rick Bayless way.
Well, my mother made it that way too.
Yeah, but most of the rest of the world, it's ground beef.
Oh yeah, I would say that probably 90% of it is ground. But you know, you get a great flavor with cubed beef on this. So.
Oh yeah. Now you have apparently there's a big argument always going on about the origins of chili. Now you have a big page full of that. What do you think is the answer?
Well, you know, the origin of chili is, I think it's steeped right here in West Texas. I think for me and my findings that it was really a cowboy stew. It was something that could be made with the chuck wagon, and I think it all kind of stemmed from there. Now there's probably origins of Czech, German, all little bit of enhancement along the way. But it was really, and then of course, coming from Mexico is the guiso, which is kind of their style of chili, but with chunks of meat, but more vegetables with it. But think out on the plains, basically had meat and water and probably some spices. And I think that's where the origin of chili comes from is the cowboys, because there wasn't lots of vegetables there. And then maybe that's where beans came in, because, you know, you had dried beans, you had a cattle, and you could put that together. But it is funny how Texas chili is very strict about no beans.
Right.
Yeah, it can be dried meat, right? It can be a variety of different forms of meat.
But it cannot have beans.
But doesn't have beans. Now, does Bill Cosby's have beans? I forget.
No. Bill doesn't like beans.
He doesn't like beans
coffee.
Either. I thought it was funny that he tested you out and then he gave you his recipe.
Right. Exactly.
So that there's a story with that.
Well, there's a great story with that.
Yeah, you have to buy the book to read the story. Let's be a little let's be a little commercial here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Steve Pyle's son of a bitch stew. I mean, I really like mishmash of stuff, but there's a bit much of this in this for me. I mean, you live in with all of this.
Well, that was the true cowboy chili right there. That was taking a cow and using everything from the cow to make a stew on the range. Heart, kidney.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can do that. I just can't. It's the liver.
Oh, I could. Believe me.
And if the cowboys hadn't actually done it that way, they would have had to throw the organ meats away, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So you got to use them right away.
Well, and if you look at old cookbooks, you know, dating back into the early 1800s, late 1700s, you saw that when you butchered a pig or a cow, you used everything. You cooked the head as a meal. Everything was used. So it's in that same aspect of the son of a bitch stew, which I definitely wanted from Stephen, because it's such a, I don't think people will ever see that again.
You mean it's not, you don't make it anymore?
You don't make it anymore. But I wanted this book to be a great Texas reference book. You know, from nachos to son of a bitch stew, everything in between, from smoking, grilling, from enchiladas to modern cooking, Texas cooking that we do at the restaurant. It's all in this book. And it has long legs, because I think years to come, this will still be a book that'll stand high, because you can go to this book and go, I need a recipe for this, Texas style. It's going to be there.
Yeah, like fried peach pies.
Now, I didn't check out the index on this one, but I'm a bit of a brave cooker myself sometimes. So not too long ago, for an audience of two people, Mark, so we ate it for a week. I cooked three beef tongues. Three whole beef tongues.
Holy moly, Peter.
And we had breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 3 weeks.
And it was fabulous. Now, I don't think you have a tongue recipe in there. Maybe Texans don't eat tongue.
Well, they do. And I'm sure in the son of a bitch stew, they probably threw some tongue in there.
They do have it in there.
Yeah. Oh, is the tongue in there?
Yeah, I think that's
it. But I have to get all the other stuff. Now, my new butcher in Bloomfield might have them.
I'm not sure. I'm really. Yeah, well, I don't know.
But, you know, it's great to have a book where you can, you know, do great soups, great salads, talk about all different types of grilling, all different types of smoking. We have a smoked pork Austin butt, kind of, which is the part of the pig that needs some cooking. And one of my cooks, Mr. B, gave me his full recipe with injections into the pork, to sprays, to mops. And what you get out of this recipe is the greatest barbecue piece of meat ever. And that's what I wanted in this book, from simple to yet all Sunday afternoon cooking, if you wanted to be by a smoker.
Now, just to give you an idea how thorough this book is, Dean, I love the way you came up with D1 sauce.
Oh, yeah, I love that, too.
My version of A1, but yeah. It's Dean1. So.
In England, it's HP sauce. Where the H,
yeah, it sure is.
Where the HP stands for Houses of Parliament.
I never knew that. That is great to know.
Well, if you look at the label of HP sauce, it has a picture of the Houses of Parliament on it, so that's how you know.
Wow.
That is great. Well, and that's the fun part about this book, is that you can make great little twists of classic recipes and classic items that we know about. I mean, truly, who doesn't love A1 on one thing or another? We came up we said, listen, let's make our own. We have a great Caesar dressing that is smoky and has a little chili flavor in it. But you start off with the basic Caesar dressing and add a Texas flavor to it, which makes it light years above just a regular Caesar salad, I think.
Well, what we've got here, Dean, it's, you call it the Texas Food Bible. And I think what you're secretly trying to do is to convert these entire United States into part of the state of Texas, and everybody's going to revolutionize their kitchen product because they're not going to need to look at another book because it's all in here.
I love that, Peter.
So you'll have to send me one of those flags. And I'll hang it out the window.
Shoot, Peter, we might make you vice president.
No. Oh God, no. Thank you so much for joining
thank
us today.
Thank you, and thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Dean.
And thank you for letting me discuss the Texas Food Bible.
Yes, which I love. I swear on it.
Well, come down and visit me.
Okay, Dean. I'll see you then. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And if the Texas story is big, wait till you catch the interview right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, Anne said she didn't understand my hint just before the break, so let me explain it to you. Texas is big. India is bigger. and our next guest is talking about the mother and father, I guess, of all spicy cuisines, but with an interesting new approach. It's Rinku Bhattacharya.
You did it.
And she's talking not just about the spices available, that are part of the Indian palate.
But spices, as they relate to seasons. Seasons as we experience them here.
So.
Not just the
so Indian. you're gonna pick up some great clues here and I'm sure she
talks about sustainability meeting the spice issue.
So I'm sure you're gonna enjoy the conversation.
Well, Rinku, I really believe that it's been a while. I don't remember exactly how long ago.
Year, give or take.
You must be cranking out these books.
You know, that's what's very interesting. It seems because these books are so close together that I wrote them, I finished one and wrote another one. It's sometimes never quite like that. I mean, I had the idea for this book before I wrote the other book. Yes.
It can't be bad when the introduction is by Mark Twain. at least one of them anyway.
Let's
back up and just introduce a Rinku Bhattacharya. Is that good?
Yes.
And you are from Bombay, and Peter says Mumbai.
I'm actually from Kolkata, India.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's different.
Okay. Yes, different. That is different.
Now,
regionally,
it's so India has four sort of large, actually more like six these days, metropolitan cities. But roughly, you at least have one apiece in the four corners. So Mumbai is in the west, Kolkata is in the east.
Okay, now the difference between your first and your second book is what? That you added this seasonal aspect to your recipes.
Yes, I mean, I think in some ways my first book also was quite focused on the regional cuisine of Eastern India.
Uh-huh.
I think in some ways that was probably personally, the personal aspect of the book,
right,
that focused a lot on my childhood cooking that I grew up with. This book probably is closer to cooking my children are growing up with.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, before we even sort of dissect how the structure of the book and some of the recipes, I want to say that the recipes are absolutely delicious sounding. I mean, I look at, from one to the other, I get all enthralled with kale and potato patties, and then I see your chopped suckers. These are summer, and we're right in the middle of summer now, and you do say it's seasonal. Mm-hmm. But as a reader could pick up this book without knowing anything about your last book and have everything they need to know to start cooking really modern, and although there's tradition in it, but fresh Indian food.
Yes, I mean, that was my intent, and if I do have other cookbooks, I mean, I think you can go both ways with cooking and writing cookbooks. One can link to another. These two books are quite discreet, and I think, you know, that's what makes Indian cooking so magical. You can write completely different cookbooks, still have them very Indian. Because there's a lot of diversity in the cuisine.
Now, you talk a lot about your garden, and, and you manage in New York State now to go through, what, three seasons?
Yes. I mean, winter really is a very slow season, at least in terms of growing things in New York. I mean, we do have certain things that we store, quite particularly the winter squashes. In fact, it was a surprise to me because when I first, the first year we were growing them, I told my, I'm not the gardener, actually, my husband
Your
is.
Your husband is the gardener.
Yes, yes.
And you do the
cooking. So I told him, wait a minute, these are supposed to be winter squashes. Why do they grow in August? He said, that's what's interesting. They store very well. And because, you know, people, if you really want to conserve them, and what, most years, we get about 16 to 17 squashes. They do certainly last us through December. Because obviously you can't only be eating squashes. Certain things stay underground also, as I learned. I mean, I grew up very urban. My husband, I mean, I think had a gardener mother, and I think it runs in their family.
Well, so, you are an accountant. I find it really difficult to picture you as an accountant, except for the fact, because these recipes are so scrumptious, but actually the accountant part of you comes out with your total organization. I mean, this is beautifully organized.
I find the dealing with the keeping the recipes organized, keeping the project aspect of it, a lot of my training comes in handy. But I think, you know, all of us have multiple dimensions to our interests and personalities. I do like numbers almost as much as I like cooking.
Now, you did not, however, even though the title of this book, which I don't even think we mentioned, is Spices and Seasons, Simple, Sustainable Indian Flavors, for some reason you do not organize the book according to the seasons, which was a popular way of organizing season-emphasizing books. Why is that?
Why is that? Because I feel seasons differ from one part of the world to another. And while I can suggest certain things, I don't want the reader to get obsessed with the fact that, oh my God, she thinks this is a summer fruit, but, you know, we get this in December. Take, for example, a lot of the things that I'm growing in my garden now, like, coming to think of it, something like fenugreek is considered a winter green in India. There's no way it will grow in winter here. So, I mean, I think I've gone through it. I've certainly talked about the seasons, but I personally feel I want this to, you know, translate across the country, across different places of the world. And I do realize that, you know, what we think of in spring can be very different from what someone in Texas thinks of in spring.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Now, I just learned something already, which I didn't know. which is the fenugreek is a green vegetable. I mean, I associate it with a pale yellow powder.
Well, the plant eventually flowers and the seeds are pale yellow, but the greens are actually edible.
Does it taste like kale?
It is milder than kale, and the leaves are much, much softer.
Okay, we think kale is so good for us, we should eat it at least 4 times a week.
Fenugreek is almost as good for you. It's just kale is more readily available. If you have to get fenugreek greens, you can grow them. But I realize they're very easy to grow.
Listen, one of your points is that you want these recipes and Indian cooking, authentic Indian cooking, to be accessible to everyone, and particularly people like you, who's a working mother with two mm-hmm. small children. You don't want, we can say what the book is not about, you don't want to have difficult to access ingredients, endless simmering and cooking with, you know, that you can't control. And you want them to be doable and healthy. Is that like, mm-hmm. in a nutshell, mm-hmm. what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's talk about some of your favorite recipes here. I mean, I just recently learned that radishes could be cooked. And I'm looking at this wonderful radish and scallion fritters.
Yes, everyone gets a kick out of that one. And believe it or not, that's a very, very interesting way of cooking it. I mean, it's something making those fritters, there's nothing unique about them. We have various kind of vegetable fritters. But 1 year when I was overflowing with radishes, I said, hey, let me slice them up and see what happens.
So this is an innovation on your part. Nobody else cooks them?
The radish and scallion fritters, I'm not so sure. I don't think so. I mean, it's not even a popular, cooking them this particular way in India. There is a stir-fried radish and radish greens recipe. That is quite traditional. It's very traditionally North Indian. I mean, I've probably notched it down a little bit. I mean, what I've done with a lot of the recipes is when I've tested and retested them, I've tried to keep the ingredients as manageable as possible without compromising flavor.
But you indicate, I can't remember the word you used, that you really have streamlined these mm-hmm. recipes down to their basic, simplest form to make them accessible to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that while, again, there are a lot of spices in Indian cooking that work in the background to probably enhance flavors. Sometimes, you know, you probably don't need quite so many. You can still get reasonably good results. And when you're cooking on an everyday basis, quite often those are the spices you use. That's what my mother uses too. But it's just that when we present it, we kind of think, oh my God, this is so simple. This is what we make at home. When we are telling someone outside how to cook, we should present our most complex recipes. And I think there's a place for that. I think some days we have more time to cook, and there are recipes in the book, like in the holiday section or some of the curries, that are more complicated. And then there are others that what I feel is, I mean, I think it's like an 80-20 rule. 80% of our time, you want something on the table, then, you know, that fits in with your lifestyle. And, of course, if you have a lot of time in your life, by all means, you can make my recipes more complicated or cook more things. But most people, you know, if you're not working, there's something else you're involved with. If it's not the children, there's something else you're busy with.
I have an interesting question for you. It's not exactly apropos to this book, but it's something that's always intrigued me about, particularly Indian cooking. When you go to an Indian restaurant, often they will say, how spicy would you like it on a scale of 1 to 10? And if you say 8, or if you say 2, what do they do? I mean, there's a mystery going on in the pot back there. Is there something that they can put in that will transform a 2 to an 8 in like 5 minutes or less?
Really, what they're doing is playing around with the amount of cayenne pepper that they're adding to the dish.
So they're putting that in at the last minute.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether you really, it doesn't lend, Kayan does not necessarily lend itself to being added at the last minute for all the dishes, but you know, again, they have to work with what they have. I personally think salt and cayenne pepper are awfully similar in that, well, not in taste, in concept. I mean, you know, just like if you don't like it salty, you tone down the spice, the salt level, same thing. If something is not meant, you know, it's not palatable to you as very spicy, by all means, you should notch down the amount of chili peppers. I do that for my kids all the time.
You would, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some children are born with naturally very spicy palates. Unfortunately, my kids aren't one of those.
A book about, what is it called? My Little Monkey or Hungry Monkey, I guess it's called. And he talked about he was a food writer, and he talked about his daughter developing this taste for spice when she was two. And then several months later, she had no taste for spice whatsoever because palates change all the time.
That is true, too. That is absolutely true. So my young ones, well, they are very adventurous. I mean, they're very willing to try new flavors. They love trying out a new cuisine. They just aren't naturally very attuned to very spicy food. I do think, though, that grows, maybe not for everyone. I myself used to have very mild flavors earlier. Mm-hmm. I think I've come a long way when it comes to chili peppers, but, you know, I don't think I overdo it.
Well, it's interesting. We talked to someone several years ago who produced, was it 1,000 Indian recipes or something like that?
Oh, 550
curry recipes.
550.
And most people assume, and he explained that this is really not true, that most people think of curry as a hot sauce, when in fact all curry really means is gravy.
And
it can have any level of heat associated with it that's appropriate. So I thought that was rather clever of us to learn that, and I've never forgotten it.
Yeah, absolutely. In Indian parlance, when, let's say, my mother refers to curry, she means something that's essentially a stew. It's with sauce.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, the concept of the spice plant curry actually came about from really the colonial times when the English, they started appreciating Indian food, but then they wanted a one-stop shop. So to make them happy, I guess their cooks came up with a blend that they called the curry blend, because what they figured is, you know, if we do something that kind of captures the overall nuance of our cooking, it'll make our bosses happy. That's where the curry powder. I mean, they do have a lot of spice blends. They just don't happen to be called curry.
Right. Now, I mean, you have a section here on herbs.
Yeah.
And I don't. A lot of these herbs I don't associate with Indian food at all. I mean, like thyme, I don't recall any Indian.
No, thyme, I've also mentioned in the introduction, it's actually a substitute for carom seeds. They are very close in flavor. Thyme is more readily available.
Okay. And then, so that probably is true of all these herbs that you've listed.
Some are my personal preferences just because I have them readily available, like sage. Which I've used quite a bit, really, is just sage.
Uh-huh.
I have it. It's one of the few herbs that actually survived the New York winter.
We had one of those, too.
ours does the same thing.
We lost our lavender.
It dies right back, but once you chop all the dead wood away, it's early in the spring, it likes to start sprouting again.
Yeah, it's right. Sage does that. Thyme also usually does that.
No, our thyme died this year. The lavender died. But we had a particularly bad winter, right?
I
think yours wasn't very good either.
Maybe. No. I mean, sage was the only thing that survived.
Is that right? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other things I like about this book and want to recommend to potential readers of the book is that you devote considerable space to the issue of sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that the right way, and even to the point of grinding your own seasonings, your spices.
I try. I don't want to get preachy about it, but it is very important to me. Personally, I do think if you do it in small ways, there's much more of an impact, unless you're extremely committed and organized by doing a 180-degree change. I mean, I think, you know, every day I feel very pleased when I see, you know, in little bits and pieces, my children absorb a lot of, you know, like they realize you bring your spoons back from lunch.
Uh-huh.
If you have a brown paper bag, they usually use it at least two or three times. And these things have just become little parts of their life. I mean, I don't have to tell them again and again.
Yeah, you say to do it. You're a believer in the ocean is made up of single drops of water.
Yeah. Well, I feel I've learned it myself. It's not like I grew up. Well, actually, probably I did, because sustainability, while for us, is something we have the option for. There's a lot of everyday recycling that goes on in a country like India just because people can't afford to throw away things at the drop of a hat. A lot of the native economy, like I was recently in Orissa, where the beach has a lot of coconut palms. They use the coconut shells in so many creative ways. They make baskets, they make art. They do all kinds of things because, you know, they need to do it for their livelihood.
It reminds me of a party that we once did, my crazy friends and I, when we were young, and we decided to use coconut shells for the glasses and cups for the beer. And so we cut all the coconuts in half and then realized, of course, that half of each one had holes in it.
Yes,
so
exactly.
So we got really ingenious. We filled the holes with wax. The only problem was that it was really hot. It was in the summertime, and as guests were holding their cup of beer, the wax gave way, and then all the beer went all over. Well, anyhow, that has nothing to do with this book. No, Let's repeat again.
That kind of idiocy is not in this book, thank goodness.
It's called Spices and Seasons, and Rinku Bhattacharya, who is an expert on so many different things, all under the guise of a very interesting cookbook with delicious recipes. Rinku, good talking to you again, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then, and in the meantime,
bye-bye.